In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. It is time to reawaken this industrial giant, to get government back within its means, and to lighten our punitive tax burden. And these will be our first priorities, and on these principles, there will be no compromise.
Welcome. I'm Ben Boyce. This is the Dr. Junkie Show. And today I want to start with some housekeeping because it's been a busy year and because this show has taken some odd turns into the land of philosophy and theory lately. As to the first, the limited episodes for the last year, thanks to those of you who have sent encouraging emails and thank yous from around the world. It's always weird to realize you're being listened to across the globe. And it's always weird that the issues that we're facing here in the United States are often a problem elsewhere as well. I've been busy. Prison college education is actually taking off right now with the reintroduction of Pell Grants to incarcerated people in the United States, and I've been teaching a lot with a couple different colleges inside prisons. Plus, as you've probably been noticing, I've been reading a lot and writing a little bit. Which leads me to point two. The philosophical, theory-laden content of the show lately. What's up with that? Well, as I've said plenty of times, I'm a communication guy, so I've been keeping a close eye on the mediascape of the United States, and man, podcasts have exploded. This is good news and bad news, because it means you can find junk as easy as you can find good content. Like Kelsey's video vlog. That might not be the best place to get advice about the rash on your arm, but a YouTube video by a doctor who, say, treats skin rashes, or somebody who studies them, that might give you some insight into what's going on for free. And in this media pot of stew that we currently live in, there are some people who have showed up who are way better than I am at some things. They're way more qualified when it comes to talking about, say, drug neurology or biology. When talking about brains, bodies, adaptations, neurons, vitamins, stuff like that. The Huberman Lab, for example, is going to provide much more specific and accurate information about, say, the metabolic consequences of snorting cocaine for a week than I can. Anyway, I'm a communication doctor, not a medical doctor. And generally speaking, I've always tried to stay in my lane on this show, despite often needing to provide some sort of basic description about how certain drugs work. But as this podcast has evolved, I've started to feel like there's a more appropriate space for me to fill. One that, again, as many of you have noticed, is a bit more theory-packed and oriented on power than these shows that are about just how the body works, or just how biology works, or just history. I do, after all, literally want to abolish the war on drugs, not just convince a few people to change their mind about, say, their uncle snorting blow before Christmas morning. One more thing about the limited episodes of late. Here's the deal, and I've explained this before, so bear with me if you've heard it. It's just been a while. I think it's important for listeners to know, and it's relevant to today's topic, which I promise I'll get to in just a minute. I don't take sponsorships for this show. Even though I get frequent invites and sponsorship requests from both interested parties and from the podcast hosting website I use. That's part of why these episodes are sometimes infrequent. I don't do them for money, so I have to make sure that I pay the rent before I take the time to research and record one of these. But we also live in a neoliberal society where those with the power to control the media control the world, so to speak. Nowadays, believe it or not, 90% of what we read, watch, and listen to, it's all owned by just 6 corporations. And it shouldn't surprise any of us that they're all rich. They are, after all, corporations. So when, say, a story breaks that one of their sponsors or that one of their political people, that somebody's done something bad that they like, well, it also shouldn't surprise us that the billionaires who stand to lose money if stocks plummet or if their people lose political power, that they often soft-pedal those stories or ignore them altogether. Noam Chomsky calls this the 5 filters of media. a metaphor I like because it reveals the way that a system designed like ours will always result in this sort of selection bias regarding which stories get covered and which get ignored. What stories are important today? Well, obviously the ones that don't make us look bad. The reason I don't run ads on this show is because it would weave me into that same system of information for profit, whereby I'd be forced to conform to the censorship requirements of my sponsors. Hard pass, at least on this show. That's not why I'm here. I get it, it's just how things work, but fuck, it feels greasy, manipulative, and all the more because it's all natural in capitalism without the rails. Ooh, capitalism without guardrails. I like that as a simple definition of that term I used a minute ago, neoliberalism. And that's actually what I want to talk about today, neoliberalism and its close cousin, oligarchy. Neoliberalism, like I just said, it's basically government working for big business. The way I like to think of it is the concept of liberalism, you know, freedom from oversight, don't tread on me, pursuit of happiness, all that stuff. It's that philosophy, but not applied to individuals, but to corporations. Gross, right? Now, there's a reason, multiple reasons actually, why corporations are considered people legally. But to avoid tangents on tangents in this particular episode, I'll save Citizens United and the Buckley decision for another day. The short story is that right now in the United States, it's essentially legal to bribe politicians and Supreme Court justices, but only if you have the sort of money that, say, someone in charge of a multi-million dollar corporation might have access to. As just one brief aside, Clarence Thomas, the Supreme Court justice who recently refused to excuse himself from Trump's ballot restriction case, even though his wife was deeply involved in planning the attempted coup on January 6th, that guy, he has, according to an article in The Nation, which I've linked in the episode description, received all sorts of gifts from what would seem like some pretty shady sources considering he's, you know, a Supreme Court justice. Here's a quote from the article. Over two decades, Harlan Crow, Charles and David Koch, the Koch Network, Wayne Huizenga, David Sokol, Paul Novelli, they provided Thomas with 38 vacations, 26 private jet flights, 8 flights by helicopter, a dozen VIP passes to sporting events, attendance as a guest to the exclusive Bohemian Club, travel on a private jet to and lodging at Koch Network summits at resorts in California, tuition for his nephew in a private school, and $267,000 worth of loans used to purchase a luxury recreation vehicle. Crow even purchased the home in which Thomas' mother lived, and then allowed her to live there rent-free. Thomas reported none of this, end quote. So that's where we are right now, neoliberalism. But that's not just how it's always been in the United States. In fact, as I want to talk about today, this country was actually founded on an anti-neoliberal, anti-oligarchy attitude. Oh crap, I've used that word twice now, and I realize I'm always talking about how much I hate it when eggheads use big words that aren't necessary without defining them. Oligarchy just means rule by the rich. It describes a country or a society where those with the most wealth find themselves also occupying the most powerful positions of politics and leadership and lawmaking. Sound familiar? Yikes. So let's start way back at the beginning, and I mean way back at the beginning. In fact, I want to go back to before we actually had the Revolutionary War in the United States, and I want to focus briefly on a philosopher named Thomas Hobbes, whose big thing, you might have heard this quote, was that in a state of nature, life is short, nasty, and brutish. We don't often think about this when we're just reading philosophy for philosophy's sake, but it was 1620, and Hobbes was basically defending the king, the system as it currently was, by saying, think about how awful it would be to just wake up one day and be a human being living in the woods all by yourself and trying to defend yourself from all the threats out there. It's a good thing the king came along, and even though we have rules we have to follow, at least we have protection. So that was Thomas Hobbes. Now in 1680, 60 years later, John Locke comes along with his famous flip on that take, essentially saying that in a state of nature, before societies and cultures forced us all to conform to the rules of the majority, we actually had it a lot better. I mean, that was like the closest thing to a natural state of democracy we could have. Now, Thomas Hobbes at the time didn't know what science has since revealed, that all of that lead wolf stuff, that alpha dog, head of the pack crap, that's not really how groups of organisms actually work in the wild. They work something more like on a what you could think of as 50% rule, where, say, you see a flock of geese flying through the sky, and they turn left, or then they turn right, and you're wondering, how do they know? Generally speaking, when more than half of the pack turns their head or bodies a certain way, you will notice the rest of the flock follow. And the same holds true for things like wolves or orangutans. Anywhere these studies have been done, we find that democracy tends to be sort of the default state of nature. And this is what John Locke was basically saying. He was saying we lost something when we gave up our rights to decide how to live together to the king, who we believed for a long time to be put there by God. So now let's fast forward to the American Revolution, and let's focus on an event, the Boston Tea Party, which most of us were taught about in middle school as this big jolly affair where we got so mad at England that we threw all their tea into the harbor and that was the end of it. Now, what we're not usually told, or what we might have forgot, is the reason we were so pissed off. Because of the Opium Wars, another tangent on a tangent I could go into, England found itself in bed with certain companies that it had loaned so much money to that if these companies failed, England was in big trouble. And one of those companies was the British East India Company. It wasn't that they were bringing tea in and that the colonists hated tea so much they were going to throw it in the ocean. They were charging import taxes. And as I've described, this created a situation in England where technology in the form of weapons to ride around on these trade missions to go to China and pick up cargo to bring back to England and sell for a profit, technology in the form of ships themselves that could go carry this cargo, that was something that only the state had access to or a few incredibly rich people. And this new technology remaining in just the hands of a few was exploited to make super rich folks who owned corporations who were essentially in bed with the government. And on the day of the Boston Tea Party, the colonists said, fuck that. That is not what this country is going to be about. We threw their tea into the harbor because of that, and we kicked off what is often thought of as the beginning of a revolutionary war, where the United States decided for the first of three times, this is not going to be a country where big business gets to get in bed with the government and create all sorts of regulations that allows for super billionaires to show up at the expense of regular everyday workers. You're probably thinking, well, yeah, but wasn't slavery going on in the United States at the time? Yes, but it wasn't the industry we traditionally think of that it became shortly thereafter. And that's because without the cotton gin, which didn't show up till about 1790, 1793, one person could only clean the seeds out of something like a pound of cotton a day. So plantation owners, sure, they staked out a certain piece of land, they would go purchase enslaved people to work it for them for free, but they had no ability to make super huge plantations that were thousands of acres. They had no ability to create places like Angola that would stand to this day as one of the biggest plantations in the South, because there was no way to process all the cotton anyway. Now the cotton gin comes along and voila, suddenly a new technology shows up and it changes wealth distribution, and the people that can get a hold of it and utilize it the most, the quickest, well, they can monopolize it if they do it right. Now, remember, in the United States, we've decided from the start we're not doing things that way here, except new technology sometimes lets people slip in the cracks and change things. And this is what happened from the end of the 1700s to the middle 1800s when the Civil War kicked off, is corporations started buying out small plantations, turning them into mega farms. The price of an enslaved person is just one example of how this became evident. Went from something like $200 to $300 to something like $1,200 because huge plantations were being stretched out and widened, and lots of bodies, and in this case free labor, was needed to turn this raw cotton into actually processed cotton that could be sold. So when the Civil War kicked off, it was absolutely about this institution of slavery and, more importantly, as I've talked about, all the laws that went with it that were essentially white supremacy, that gave all these rights and privileges to white folks by law that black folks didn't have. But it's important to remember it was more than just that. It was super rich folks in the South at the expense of their towns and villages, which compared to the North were poverty stricken. Often to this day, there's legacies of that. If you drive through the South, you'll see towns that look like they're just abandoned by anybody that cares. It was always like that down there because that's what happens when neoliberalism takes hold and super rich people can accumulate massive amounts of wealth at the expense of day laborers or poor workers. The Civil War, time number two. We said, no, not going to happen in the United States. That's not what we're about. And we went to war and just barely pulled back what we could think of as democracy designed for the people. We got rid of this outbreak of neoliberalism and oligarchy, and we said, this has got to be a place where everyday people can, quote, pull themselves up by the bootstraps. Again, we've arrived at a point where many of you might be thinking, wait a second, the early 1900s, don't I remember some super billionaires arising around that time? The Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Fords. When technology emerges and a few people can get a hold of different aspects and utilize it the quickest, they often find a space where they can recreate an oligarchical system. They can accumulate massive amounts of wealth really fast and then monopolize all the production before everybody else figures out their tricks. They can buy out the farmers. They can open Walmart stores and move to every town in the country and put the mom and pop shops out of business. Aha! And this is what neoliberalism causes. All those names I mentioned, you'll remember if you're any sort of history buff, that around the turn of the century, we had monopolies that were formed, massive monopolies with money that still persists to this day. But if you're a student of history, you also remember the collapse of the late 1920s, the Great Depression. This is often what happens with neoliberalism when it gets too big for its own britches. The top falls in, and of course the people that suffer the most are the poorest. And along comes Franklin D. Roosevelt, who institutes something called the New Deal, our third time when the United States said we're not going to do business this way. Monopoly laws are enforced, big corporations are broken up, and it remains that way all the way up until 1980. And it really worked. It's just one example of how strict the United States really was when it comes to breaking up monopolies. Brown Shoe Company in 1962, they made Buster Brown shoes, they wanted to buy out some of their competition and expand their shoe market, but the purchase would have left them controlling something like around 7% of the U.S. shoe market. And the United States government sued them and said, no, that is too close to a monopoly. Now, don't forget where I started this episode by reminding us, or informing those of us that didn't know, that 90% of the media you consume, where you learn about the world, where you see what's going on around you, where you find out what's important and what's not regarding what happened today, it comes from six corporations who all have personal financial interests in different topics, in different viewpoints of the public being perpetuated and others being changed or crushed out. It's just one example. Between 1946 and 1980, the bottom 50% of the United States saw their wealth increase by 129%, whereas the top 1% only saw their wealth increase by 58%. If we follow forward that same amount of time, 34 years, same as from 1946 to 1980, same as from after the New Deal to when Ronald Reagan took office, it isn't that the bottom half's income and wealth went up 129%. Oh no, not anymore. In the next 34 years, the bottom half of this country saw their wealth increase by 21%. Whereas the top 1% of this country saw their wealth increase by 194%. I've linked these stats with some additional information about them also on the episode description if you're interested. But suffice to say, something changed in 1980, and we've now, starting in 1980 to today, moved back towards that place that we have fought off the three times it showed up in the United States, neoliberalism, and its cousin, oligarchy. Because as you can imagine, and as we've seen, when neoliberalism really takes hold, of course, oligarchy is what's next. I mean, if the CEOs want the government to work for them, why not just put a CEO or a billionaire in the president's chair, in congressional seats? Aha, that's what's happened. So in 1980, Ronald Reagan's elected on a platform of making America great again. No joke. Reagan's thing was always to figure out a way to have government help those who already had power, mainly the rich and the business-owning class. He preached this thing called trickle-down economics, which George Bush Sr. actually called voodoo economics in one of their early debates, even though he changed his tune completely later on and embraced many of the same policies. But the idea works like this. If you get more money this year, naturally you're going to give more of it to your employees. You're not going to take a larger paycheck and buy that new car you want or take your family on vacation. Oh no, not in America, where we basically base contentment on whatever new product we've bought lately. What Reagan said is, no. If we cut the top tax rate from 73%, which it was when Reagan took office, to just 28%, which he changed it to shortly thereafter, well, you'll save the richest folks in this country a load of money, but you'll also make sure that that money now has to come from somewhere else. And that's exactly what happened since Reagan's era. Now, here we are again at the end of a long episode with tons of theory and history and all sorts of new terms woven in, and you're thinking, where are the drugs? Reagan's usually the person associated with the introduction or the increase in the war on drugs in the early 1980s, just like Nixon is associated with a similar boom in the 1970s. And even though I've reminded us over and over that the war on drugs kicked off almost 100 years earlier than that, they both did boost it to an incredible level compared to what it was before. And they did that with neoliberal policies. Drugs were illegal, and we were going to have to hire new cops, and that would require some government funding. But think about where those cops are going to get things like training, guns, uniforms. Aha! Rich business owners are going to sell more of these materials. How about cars that they're going to drive, or the weapons that they're going to use? How about lawyers who are going to have to defend them along the way? In fact, if we're going to talk about the privatization of certain prison environments or certain prison services that happened shortly thereafter, you can imagine how anyone with a stake in any drug war adjacent business, say drug tests, incarceration, probation, electronic tethering, handcuff makers, all of it, they're all going to be on board with an increase on the war on drugs, because even if it doesn't look like it's a private industry, it boosts private industry. It boosts money coming from taxpayers and going not to help poor folks, not to help people who need help, but rather into the pockets of business owners who are already wealthy. Neoliberalism. So I want to keep playing with this idea moving forward, and I want to make sure we don't forget what we talked about last week with Foucault, because part of this story also has to do with language, with the way that certain words can just make us feel a certain way, and we never seem to notice when the language deployed changes our opinions about people or things or ideas. The war on drugs is actually one of the few things that even to this day remains mostly bipartisan. And that's largely been because of how political actors have used language, as we talked about with Foucault last week, to control how we actually feel about certain drugs. Senator Joe McCarthy might be a good spot to start here. In 1950, he was one of the first conservatives, or maybe the first conservative, to suggest that his fellow conservatives and Republicans use the term Democrat instead of Democratic. There's no such thing as a Democrat Party, but he said we should call them Democrats instead of Democratic, because not only does it fail to bring to mind democracy, which is what a Democrat tends to typically defend, but also we can put the emphasis on rat, Democrat. And of course, since then, that word has stuck around. I think a much better example might be a 1990 pamphlet called Language, a Key Mechanism of Control. It was published and distributed to Republicans by GOPAC, a conservative action group led by House Whip Newt Gingrich. And it actually said the quiet part out loud. Foucault's claim that language is indeed power was spelled out like this. Republican politicians and activists, Newt said, should use the following language when describing their causes and policies: common sense, freedom, peace, reform, courage, hard work, pioneer, rights, crusade, help, precious, strength, dream, liberty, pride, truth, duty. This list goes on. And again, I've linked it actually in the episode description if you want to read more. He uses these positive words that just make you feel all warm and gooey inside. And indeed, those words have been picked up by the Conservative Party to describe all of their causes, the things that they stand for, because they make the people listening feel like, yes, this must be a good idea. They're talking about prosperity. Now, on the other hand, said Newt, we should describe Democratic policies and causes using the following words: anti-child, shallow, anti-flag, disgrace, lie, sham, betray, devour, machine, sick, bizarre, obsolete, destroy, status quo, cheat, excuses, pathetic, collapse, failure, hypocrisy, self-serving, decay, incompetence, welfare. Sound familiar? Now let's weave this all together, because as I said last week with our content about Foucault, language is indeed power in that it fires how we feel and how we understand the world around us. The language we use to describe something literally decides how our listener feels about the thing. And the language that's been used to describe the war on drugs, as we all know, is mostly stuff on that second list, at least when it comes to users and dealers, and mostly stuff on that first list, at least when it comes to drug warriors and politicians that pass anti-drug laws. But as I explained earlier, the war on drugs is actually designed to benefit rich folks who own businesses whereby they can sell products that are used to fight the war on drugs. That's how war always works. But you can't defend it that way. I mean, can you imagine Mitch McConnell getting in front of Congress and saying, look, people, I'm trying to get my rich billionaire friend an extra $100 million next year by selling drug tests. Why don't we just require every driver in Arizona to take a drug test to get their license or something like that? No. What we hear instead are lines like this, delivered by Jefferson Sessions, our attorney general under Donald Trump.
Colorado was one of the leading states that started the movement to suggest that marijuana is not dangerous. Good people don't smoke marijuana.
Those weren't just random words. So I don't want to go too far with this idea today. I feel like I've given you a lot to chew on. But I want to pick this back up and keep adding to our theory about how our views on drugs work as we build a model that eventually will give us some ways to change the way people think about drugs and eventually to change policy. Thanks for listening. I hope you got something out of this episode. I'm Ben Boyce.
What happens in 1982? Well, Ronald Reagan is president, and the good news is we are into trickle-down economics. And here it is. And this chart tells it all.